How you found it, singing that Psalm 107 to a Christmas carol. I thought if the choir could change the tune to a well-known carol, but keep the words, we could change the words and keep the tune, if that makes sense. And should we think about it? But it was interesting, wasn't it, to see what things are brought out. Interesting ways of understanding and thinking about the psalm. I think it's good, you know, if we're reading and going through the psalms to try and sing it, if we can find a version that works. And so I thought it was okay, wasn't it? It was good to sing it together. Well, we're going to look this evening, as you see on the screens, at the topic of thankfulness, and we're going to look together at Psalm 107. I wonder if I were to ask you the question, what should be the fundamental attitude of the Christian? What would you say? We might say that we should first and foremost be loving people. Perhaps we'd say first and foremost we should be joyful people. Well, there are probably many things that a Christian should be, but one thing that a Christian should certainly be is thankful. You might say the one word that should sum up a Christian is that they are a thankful person. The great preacher Martin Lloyd-Jones certainly felt that. He thought that thankfulness is so important, he chose to preach 8 sermons from this one psalm. Now, you know, Lloyd-Jones took his time in preaching. I don't propose to go through in 8 sermons. We're going to go through in 1 sermon. But he said this of this idea of thankfulness, the fundamental note of Christianity, and therefore the chief characteristic of a Christian, is giving thanks to God. And if you think about it in Scripture, thankfulness is a key theme, isn't it? It comes up again and again and again. There's a very good reason for that, because thankfulness changes where we relate to God. If your relationship with someone is a little bit difficult or a bit strained, and then that person does something that's very kind to you or for you, that instantly changes how you feel about them, doesn't it? Changes how you relate to them. You're no longer angry towards them. You try hard not to grumble about them, and you're just grateful for what they have done. And in this psalm, God calls us, each one of us, to be thankful and to express that thankfulness to the Lord. It begins in verse 1 with a phrase that actually you find again and again in the Psalter. It's in many psalms. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. Now you find that in many, many psalms. But what's interesting about this psalm is the way in which it tells us, or the reason it gives us for thankfulness. Because what you find in many of the psalms that talk about thankfulness to God is they give many different reasons for thankfulness. So you might have a few verses on one thing, a few verses on something else, a few verses on something different. But this psalm only really gives one reason to be thankful. Just one reason to be thankful. And it's found in verse 2. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he has gathered from trouble. And what you find is that this psalm keeps on going back again and again to that one reason. That the Lord has rescued us. That we have been redeemed from trouble. And we are, therefore, the redeemed of the Lord's. And there are so many reasons for a Christian to be thankful, but I think it's right to say the biggest reason is we've been saved, our salvation. Now, I was writing this sermon on Friday during the work day, and I was very thankful for my noise-canceling headphones, which I had on, and I was largely oblivious to what was going on, all the hard work that was going on in the building at the work day. But someone was doing some work hammering on a wall just outside one of the office walls, and I was certainly aware of the hammering. But it did make me think, and I'm thankful for the illustration that it gave to me for the sermon, because it seems to me that what the Lord is doing in this passage is a bit like what happens when you're hammering a nail into the wall. If you try to hammer a nail in with one shot, what happens? It doesn't work, does it? You miss, and that hurts a lot, or, you know, it goes in the wrong way, it doesn't go straight. The way you get the nail in is you hammer it in gradually and carefully until it's where you want it to be. And that's a bit like what God is doing in this psalm. He is hammering the idea of thankfulness because of salvation again and again and again. Now, I won't push the illustration any further because it could be saying some interesting things about us, couldn't it? But there we are. But what the Lord is doing is he is repeatedly saying you need to be thankful. And you need to be thankful because of salvation. And thankfulness doesn't come naturally. The Lord knows that, and so he drives it home through repetition. And so what we're going to see this evening is that the psalm gives us four different pictures of that one truth. Four different pictures of our amazing salvation, and they're all there to teach us to be thankful. And the first picture is this. I should be thankful for salvation because God has rescued me from a dry desert. God has rescued me from a dry desert. That's the first picture, and it's there in verses 4 to 9. And each of these is a picture of what it's like to come to Jesus and be saved. So before we come to Jesus in verse 4, we're pictured as wandering in desert wastes. If we could find a city, we would have food and water and shelter, but we can't get there. And so, verse 5, we are hungry and thirsty, and our soul is fainting. This section is the picture of the drought that comes with unbelief. Without God, you are looking for something, anything to satisfy that deep thirst inside of you for something more. You're searching for living water to satisfy your soul. But what you find is that all the wells you run to run dry. They might satisfy for a time, but eventually they run empty because nothing but God can satisfy that thirst. Charles Darwin rejected God and tried to build his life upon secular humanism. But later in life, he found that it didn't satisfy. As he grew older, he wrote of how he was losing his taste for life. He couldn't get anything out of poetry or music or art. He was seeking living water. He was thirsty. But he couldn't find it. And that's what life without God is like. It's dry. It's barren. But then we read in verse 6 that we call out to God and he answers us. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble and he delivered them from their distress. Now one of the reasons why I think it's very clear these four pictures in this psalm are all about this one thing of salvation is because you get two repeated phrases in each of the four pictures. You might have heard those as Wendy read it for us. The first repeated phrase is there in verse 6, that we cry out to the Lord, and the Lord delivers them from distress. And how does God deliver? Verse 5, he leads us by a straight way to a city of safety where we can dwell. So we're taken from a dry, deadly desert to a city that satisfies, or where God will satisfy, the longings of our soul. Verse 9. Where he fills us up with good things. Isn't that a wonderful picture of salvation? Of being filled with good things as we come to Jesus and find that living, lasting water. And then there is a second repeated phrase, and it's the repeated phrase is there to tell us what we should do in response to God's amazing salvation. And it's first mentioned in verse 8. Let them thank the Lord for his steadfast love, for his wondrous works to the children of men. The right response of you and I to God's salvation is thankfulness. Thankfulness. That's the first picture. Let's go on to the second one. So God has rescued me from a dry desert. Secondly, God has freed me from captivity, verses 10 to 16. The picture here is of redemption being like being freed from imprisonment. And so we're pictured in verse 10 as being sat in darkness, in the shadow of death. We are prisoners locked in irons, unable to escape. Now, why has this happened? We're told in verse 11, it's happened because we've rejected God and rebelled against God's word and God's ways. And in rejecting God's ways, the Lord has allowed us to become captive to our sin. He has given us over to it in that sense. Now, to be without God and to be caught in sin is a kind of slavery, isn't it? We're unable to break free from the things that captivate and control us. Instead of us making our own life choices, it's sin that seems to make the choices for us. We might try and break free, but we just can't. And so we get an end. We get to an end of ourselves. And what do? We call out to the Lord, and the Lord delivers us. Again, that repeated phrase in verse 13. And how does God do that? And the picture here is really powerful. God brings us out of darkness, out of that dark dungeon. He bursts the handcuffs, bursts our bonds apart, verse 14. He shatters, verse 16, the strong metal doors that keep us in. And he, verse 16, cuts in two the bars of iron that block our escape. I think one of the lovely things about these four pictures is we'll probably all be able to identify with one of them. Because everyone's story is a bit different, isn't it? Some of us might be like that person in the desert, longing for, thirsting for more, and we seek it in all these different places, but we find it ultimately in God's. But maybe you were like this person as a Christian. You were a sinner. You knew you were a sinner, and you were doing wrong things in your life, and you couldn't change. You wanted to be different, and you wanted to be new, but it was impossible. And then Jesus came, and he set you free. And it's important to notice that God doesn't just set you free from prison. He destroys everything that could keep you captive. Do you see the way it's described there? There's no chance that sin can take you captive again because the handcuffs are broken. Because the door is shattered, the iron bars are cut in two. And that means if the means of your captivity are gone, you cannot be enslaved again. So how should you respond to this amazing rescue? Well, it's there, the repeated phrase in verse 15. Let them thank the Lord for his steadfast love, for his wondrous works to the children of men. The right response is thankfulness to God for his deliverance. Third reason. So we've seen freedom from captivity. We've seen rescuing from a dry desert. Now we get to God has healed me from sickness, verses 17 to 22. And the third picture of what it's like to be without God is that it's like we have a terrible disease. And we're foolish, verse 17. We live in our own sinful ways, and because of those sins, we suffer and are afflicted. We loathe food and we draw near to the gates of death. We are helpless. Our bodies will not eat as death draws near. One of the hardest things to see is someone dying gradually as their body gives up. Sickness strikes them down and they lose interest in food and drink. You try to tempt them to eat, but they won't take it. And being without God is like a slow death that comes from disease. There is no cure. And so we're left to do all that we can. Verse 19, we cry out to the Lord. And the Lord delivers. Now remember the similarity. There's a similar picture going on each time. There's similar phrases in each of the pictures. But there are differences. And the difference in verse 20 is interesting. How does God deliver us? In each of the other pictures, we are not told how God delivers. But in verse 20, we are. God delivers by sending what? By sending his word to save us. God sent out his word and healed them. And it's the word of God that comes and heals. It shows us our sin. It shows us our need of Christ. It tells us about Jesus. And when we believe that word about Jesus and we come to faith, we are healed. And how should we respond to God's amazing rescue? We're starting to see the pattern, aren't we? Verse 21, let them give thanks to the Lord for his steadfast love, for his wondrous works to the children of men, of man. But again, there's a bit more detail here. There's similarity, but there's development. And in verse 22, we're told how we should show this thankfulness. We're given a hint of what it looks like. And it's there in verse 22. We should tell of God's deeds with songs of joy. Now that's interesting, isn't it? That the Lord calls us to express our thankfulness by singing of what God has done. Now notice it doesn't say, sing with thankfulness only if you have a nice voice. It doesn't say, sing with thankfulness only if you can sing in tune. It doesn't say, sing with thankfulness only if you know the tune. And nor does it say, sing with thankfulness only if you like the song. It says, tell of God's deeds with songs of joy. And I think it's a great shame that in many churches, much of the singing that was congregation has been taken over by a professional choir. Such that instead of being done by the people of God, it's done for them in their place. Now, I know the original purpose of those choirs was to assist the congregation to sing better, but that's not how it's done so much now, is it? It's like we pay people to say thank you for us. It's a bit weird, that, isn't it, really, if you think about it? But that's, in some ways, what happens. But the Bible is so strong on this, isn't it, that an expression of our thankfulness and praise to God is singing. Now, why is it do that? Why is that so important? Well, singing is important because it demonstrates the greatness of the person you are singing about. Because you and I sing for our heroes, don't we? We sing about the things we love. We sing about the things that we think are great. One of the things I enjoy listening to, and I certainly put on a noise-canceling headphones on Friday, is classical music. And many pieces were written to praise a king or a queen. And their purpose was to show how great the king or queen was. So Bach's masterful Brandenburg concertos were written to praise the Duke of Brandenburg because Bach hoped he would give him a job. Can you believe that? That was his CV. Here, have 6 amazing concertos and give me a job. That's what he did because he wanted to say, look, I think you're a great person. Handel wrote music for the coronation anthems, called the coronation anthems, because he wanted to praise King George. That's what he was doing. And when you and I sing, we are declaring that the God of heaven is great and mighty and wonderful. We are declaring that he has rescued us from our sin, and we are visibly declaring that to the world. So people look at you and they see they're singing. Who are they singing about? They're singing about God. Why? Because God has saved them. So it's good and right to sing in thankfulness. Let's come on to the fourth picture of salvation. The fourth picture is in verses 23 to 32. And it's a picture of redemption as being saved from a storm at sea. So it says, people go out to sea, verse 23, and they're doing business on the great waters. But then a storm comes. Now the idea here, I think, is that we're going about our lives without any thought for God. And then trouble or a storm, difficulty comes into our lives and that causes us to cry out to God. We read about the storm in verse 25. It is sent by God into our lives so we might see that he is real. Now, if you want to see the power of God, look at a storm. I don't know about you, but I'm not a fan of traveling across the open sea on a boat. I don't like storms. I get pretty sick, especially if the boat starts to move. I'm baffled why people want to spend a holiday on a ship, on a cruise. I mean, for me, if you've got to get on a boat, get to the other side, get off and enjoy the holiday. But don't stay on the ship. Now, look at how the waves are described in verse 26. They mounted up to heaven, and they went down to the depths. It makes you seasick just reading it, doesn't it? All the up and down and up and down. And these storms of life change your attitudes. That confidence that everything was okay and you were going about your life, you were doing your business, is gone. It kills your courage and your confidence. It causes you to stumble about, the picture there of the sailors staggering like drunken men. It makes you helpless. And God sometimes sends storms into people's lives so that they might turn to him. And he does that because when you get into the storm, you see that you are helpless, you have nothing else to do, and you cry out to God. And maybe that's your story. Maybe that's what happened in your story of coming to faith. And that's the sailors in the midst of this storm cry out to the Lord, verse 28, and the Lord delivers again. He stills the storm, he hushes the waves, the waters are quiet, and he brings them to their desired haven. And then how shall we respond? Well, the repeated phrase in verse 31, let them thank the Lord for his steadfast love, for his wondrous works to the children of men. So we've seen these four pictures of salvation that all end with a call to praise God. So now I want to ask a question. Why does the Lord call us again and again to thankfulness in this psalm? Why is it such an important attitude for the believer? Why does God want you to be a thankful Christian? Well, before advertising standards were introduced, advertisers could make all kinds of outrageous claims about the effectiveness of particular drugs or foods. And they're quite funny if you do some research into things they said. So you get adverts for Bovril, and it's claimed to be the cure to all kinds of physical problems. Drink Bovril, it'll be better. You know, bicarbonate of soda is made to sound like a wonder drug. And they could do that because there were no advertising standards to say, well, hang on, that's not quite right. Now, what I want to say is that thankfulness is a bit like that, insofar as it, but it's not fake advertising to do it. Yeah? It's a bit like a wonder drug for the Christian. Because it transforms so many different things. If you can stir up thankfulness in your heart, so many different things and so many different areas will be affected. And I just want to mention two for us this evening. First of all, thankfulness is a fuel for obedience. Thankfulness is a fuel for Christian obedience. If you are thankful to someone, you will desire to please them. And so if we're looking for the power and the strength to please God, thankfulness is part of what will help with that. Obedience is a hard thing, isn't it? There are struggles. God's commands are hard to keep. And there are times when you want to give up or give in. But if you remember that God has redeemed you and he calls you to obey, then your thankfulness will fuel your obedience. Because we want to please God because he has done all this for us. Francis Schaeffer thought that the lack of thankfulness was the base cause of all sin. Right from Adam and Eve's first sin in the garden, he said this, the beginning of man's rebellion against God was and is the lack of a thankful heart. The beginning of rebellion against God is the lack of a thankful heart. So if you're finding that you are losing the battles against sin in your life, it might be because you don't have a thankful heart. If you're looking for fuel to stoke that fire of obedience, thankfulness is the fuel. So thankfulness will fuel obedience. But then, secondly, thankfulness protects against a grumbling spirit. Thankfulness protects against a grumbling spirit. So often, how we feel is framed by our immediate experiences, isn't it? Our mood is driven by what's happened in the day or in the last hour, in the last few minutes. How our favourite team has performed, whether the children have been difficult. What has happened at work just before you left, and that can affect us deeply, can't it? Now that's not a wrong thing, we're emotional beings. God has made us that way. We are made so that we respond to things that happen to us. And the Lord, in this psalm, is not asking you and I to forget those things. But he's asking us to look at something bigger than any of those things. So it's not a call to forget what's happened, but it's a call to look beyond to something bigger. Because if you have experienced the rescue that we've looked at tonight, then that should deeply affect how you feel. That should fundamentally affect your mood. And as you begin to see that, some of those other reasons that might affect our mood, that might overpower us, in fact, they are overpowered by the amazing reality of what God has done for us in Christ. You know, Christians should not be grumpy people. We shouldn't, should we? That shouldn't characterize us as believers. We shouldn't be grumpy people. We should be thankful people. Of all people, we should be thankful. Now, I came down on Friday morning this week and came down for breakfast. The boys all said good morning with a smile and tried to pick me up, but I didn't show a thankful spirit at all. I was tired. I was grumpy. I knew I should never have committed to the DIY project over Christmas, because there's always too much else on. It's never a good idea. I knew I was going to be busy, but I had to finish it. And as usual, there were more problems than I thought. It was taking longer than I thought. I knew it was going to be a long day at work, and I didn't want to come home and finish the glossing. I just didn't want to do that. But that's not how I should have been thinking that Friday morning, is it? I should have been thinking how thankful I am to be one of the redeemed of the Lord's. How thankful I am. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't times for sadness and there aren't times for weeping. But what I am saying, and what I think the scriptures teach, is that the general attitude, the general tone of a believer should be thankfulness. And the thing about thankfulness is you have to keep on working at it again and again and again. One of the unintentional design benefits of the building work has been an improvement in the view out of my window. As you may know, I used to have an office on Cottage Road, ground floor, and I used to look out onto traffic and people. And then we had a break-in, two break-ins, so we boarded up the window and I looked onto a white board. And that was my view out of Cottage Road. But now, as I look out from my window at the back of the church, I have this wonderful view of Hall Park. And I'm not sure it's been good for my productivity, but it's certainly been good for illustrations. And one thing I've noticed over Christmas is an increase in the number of families teaching their children to ride their bike. So before Christmas, you don't see many families out there, but once Christmas has happened, you see all these dads running alongside their children, trying to teach them to ride the bike because they've bought a bike for Christmas and they will teach their children to ride it. And that's what they're doing. They're committed. Now, how do you ride a bike? Well, repeated practice. It's a hard thing to do. It takes years. It's usually pretty painful, both for child and parents. But you have to keep on trying. And once you get it, you have to keep going. And if you don't do it for a while, you have to learn again a bit, don't you? Because you've forgotten. So to get steady again. And thankfulness is a bit like that. It requires us to adopt new ways of thinking, and that's hard work, but it's worth it. It's worth it. So I want to close with some practical suggestions. How can we stir up this thankful spirit that will fuel obedience, that will stop us from a grumpy attitude? Well, first of all, what about this? Start each day by focusing on what the Lord has done for you in the morning. Start each day by focusing on what the Lord has done for you in the morning. It might be that you have a verse for the week that you're memorizing that reminds you of God's rescue. Maybe it's something in Ephesians 2. Maybe it's one of the verses in this psalm, verse 1, 2, or 8 would all do. Or maybe you have a phrase that you use to remind yourself of all the reasons you have to be thankful. I have one. It was given to my friend in the States, and he used to say this to Matthew. He said, "Matthew, it's a good day, you're forgiven. It's a good day, you're forgiven." And as you face the challenges of the day, and all the things happen that cause you to be difficult to be thankful, you keep on going back to that verse or that truth that you had in your heart in the morning. So when the car wing mirror falls off, your windscreen wipers break, and the Xmas exercise machine breaks down, and you think everything is breaking. It's happened to me one day this week. All of that happened. And you think, how am I going to fix all these things? It's just not going to happen. You say, no. It's a good day. I'm forgiven. It's a good day. Or maybe as you're leaving work and an email lands in your inbox, it's always a bad thing to check your email before you leave work, isn't it? Never do that because something always hits you. But an email lands in your inbox, it means a project you've been working on for months has been shelved by the company. You've put hundreds of hours into it, and in one management meeting, the work has been dismissed and confined to the archives. And everything inside of you wants to grumble and complain, you want to sin, you want to moan. But you won't do that, because God has done something amazing that's bigger than even that. It's a good day. You are forgiven. Because God has freed you from captivity. God has rescued you from a dry desert. God has healed you from sickness. And God has saved you from a storm. And so, we'll choose to have our spirit shaped by that reality. We'll choose to have our hearts framed by that truth. And we'll say, along with the psalmist, "Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever."